Boys, and you're listening to KBOO.
The following program is a rebroadcast. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred. Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Portland.
Today, we're joined by Matthew of KBOO's Gremlin Time
and Professor Lisa Neville of Portland University, way over there in upstate New York.
And the book we're looking at today is a short but densely packed monograph on Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt by Diane Negra. She's a professor of film studies and screen culture and the head of film studies at the University College of Dublin. So, and this book is published by Liverpool University Press in its Auteurs series. It's an academic book, so it's filled with words like actival. It's an adjective for somebody who's doing an action. Nevertheless, it is full of insight. For example, at one point, she writes that the murder-minded neighbor Herb, with the mother who's always in middling health, anticipates Norman Bates of Psycho 20 years later. The author goes on to link the film to Freud's so-called family romance, to women-driven gothic films of the 40s, to film noir, to nostalgia for home and the wartime culture, forms of transportation and their regulation, and the films, finally, dealing with the film's cultural afterlife. You know, when I recently rewatched the movie, I felt a growing anxiety knowing that this wonderful place where young Charlie is living was going to be riven by the appearance of her uncle, whom she has summoned somehow or another. But I'm sure that this anxiety was the actual effect that Hitchcock and his writers were seeking to establish. For example, Billy Wilder once said, and I think Hitchcock said it too, always use your objects to tell your story.
And Hitchcock uses objects in a very unique way, almost like a sleight of hand artist, as a way to draw the audience's attention into the story and not to be aware that they're being given all sorts of information. None better than in the start of this movie, Shadow of a Doubt, which opens in a sort of devastated eastern city, and we find Uncle Charlie, played by Joseph Cotten, on the
Spencer.
Run from the police.
Mr. Spencer, I hate to bother you, but I thought you'd like to know there were two men here. Two men asking for you. A young man and a kind of older man.
You know, Mrs. Martin, it's very funny. They aren't exactly friends of mine. They've never seen me. That's odd, isn't it?
It is odd, like you say.
Now that I'm here, I'll have to meet them. I may even go out and meet them.
And he decides he's going to go visit his sister to get away from them.
Hmm? I want to send a telegram to Mrs. Joseph Newton in Santa Rosa, California.
And he sends a telegram.
Here's the message. Ready? I'm coming out to stay with you a while. Stop. Will arrive Thursday and try and stop me. Will wire exact time later. Love to you all. And a kiss for little Charlie from her Uncle Charlie. That's right. That's the signature. Uncle Charlie. That's right. Santa Rosa. Santa Rosa, California.
As we come into Santa Rosa, Doug was asking, are we tense because Uncle Charlie is going to invade somehow this idyllic community? I think yes, because the camera does. I mean, first of all, he says, try and stop me. It's almost veiled threat, right? I'm going to come no matter what. And then the camera does this series of wonderful shots of Santa Rosa. You've got this bird's eye view of the town. Then it comes in and you see the cop, which again, four times you see this cop at the crossroads directing people into the town. So he's ushering us in, as the audience, into the town. Then we get closer to Charlie's house and we see the outside of the house. Then we see the window. Then we come in through the window. And finally, there she is lying on the bed in the upstairs bedroom.
Played by Teresa Wright.
In exactly the same way that Uncle Charlie was lying. Then the camera goes down, it goes through the floor to Anne, as you mentioned, and the whole mess with the telegram.
Anne, answer the telephone.
Newton's residence, Anne Newton speaking. Oh, hello, Mrs. Henderson. This is Anne. Mother isn't home yet. A telegram? Well, I don't see a pencil, so maybe she better call you back. I'm trying to keep my mind free of things that don't matter. because I have so much to keep on my mind.
And she just puts it off. So here the audience is waiting for this telegram to be received, and it's not received. And it's this sort of sleight of hand thing that Hitchcock does in other movies, and Lady Vanishes for one. And he'll bring up something, hang it right in front of the audience, and then it'll just hang there. And the audience is waiting for the characters to find it also.
And comes back up to Charlie, and the whole notion here is that Charlie is discontent.
Have you ever stopped to think that a family should be the most wonderful thing in the world? That this family's just gone to pieces?
We have?
Of course we have. Just sort of go along and nothing happens. We're in a terrible rut. It's been on my mind for months. What's going to be our future?
Oh, come now, Charlie. Things aren't as bad as that. The bank gave me a raise last January.
Money. How can you talk about money when I'm talking about souls?
So it begins with her discontent and her awareness that something's wrong in their life and something is rotten in the state of Santa Rosa.
Oh, now, Charlie, you're right. Absolutely right. I'll figure out some way.
I don't believe in good intentions anymore. All I'm waiting for now is a miracle.
Oh, Charlie.
The mom comes in and they talk with Charlie.
What's the matter, Charlie? What's the matter, Joe?
Well, it seems that...
I've become a nagging old maid.
Mother, I don't see why you let that child yell at you like that.
She's going downstairs anyway.
Joe, what were you both talking about when I came in? Something about a miracle?
And so here, while the audience is waiting for the family to see that there is a telegram for them, young Charlie comes up with the idea of sending her own telegram to her Uncle Charlie to come here and get them out of this rut that she believes that they're in.
All this time there's been one right person to save us. Mother, what's Uncle Charlie's address?
Uncle Charlie? Now, you're not going to ask him for money, are you?
Of course not. That wouldn't help us.
And now here again, just as we're about to get around to telegrams and Uncle Charlie, Hitchcock brings in another distraction.
Do you know how many steps I have to take to get from here to your drugstore and back? 649.
No, if you've forgotten, I'm not going to tell you.
Because we're still in the exposition, and we're still learning about the dynamic within this family.
I remember Philadelphia.
But, darling, you can't ask a busy man like that to come all this way for nothing.
He'll come for me. I'm named after him.
And so young Charlie takes off for the telegraph office, but the audience knows that a telegram's already been sent to them. And so now we're waiting for the mom to find out about the telegram, but here Hitchcock continues to introduce us to this family.
Emmy, Anne says we have a telegram. I think you ought to find out about it. Somebody might be sick or something.
Mrs. Henderson didn't read the telegram couldn't find a pencil. When I have a house of my own, it's going to be full of all sharpened pencils.
Did Mrs. Henderson say who the telegram was from?
No, she didn't.
Well, I think
I think she might have said who it was from. I'm going to tell everyone.
Call up and find out.
You're
one in
a
million.
Just a second. So Charlie's running down to the telegraph office to telegraph Uncle Charlie, but he's already coming. So there's that dramatic irony that we know and they don't know. And
Charlie, just call up your house. Telegram for your mother.
Did you?
I'm gonna send up my bill for us, but you can take it.
Thanks.
From your uncle. This is spoiled on you.
My uncle Charlie.
Sure.
And it sets up the initial introduction of the anxiety, making the audience go, well, when are they going to find out about the telegram?
Well, in a regular film, you'd see the telegram and someone go, oh, Uncle Charlie's coming to visit. Oh, is there something wrong with Uncle Charlie? I don't know. You know, we would have a debate on that. But here, it's a lot more layered with the different characters going back and forth with the family. And this leads up to this idea that Lisa's pointed out about telepathy, that when Charlie finds out that the telegram is from Charlie has already arrived, she has this epiphany about, you know, telepathy, and it's a miracle because she was thinking that he should come, and here he is.
Mrs. Henderson, do you believe in telepathy?
Well, I ought to. That's my business.
Oh, not telepathy, mental telepathy.
And so the whole telegram thing is discarded at this point to bring up something else. And so the audience has been led to this.
He heard me.
And we see once again the uniqueness of Charlie in this town. The entire town is very much alike in their boosterism and their white American middle classism and their materialism and their cheerful optimism. I mean, they're all nice people. And right. Charlie isn't unkind, but she's aware that there's something different in the world and there's more to the world. And she talks to the telegraph woman, Mrs. Henderson, I think, and she says, oh, that must be telepathy. When she realizes, Mrs. Henderson tells her, your uncle already is coming.
Well, suppose you have a thought, and suppose the thought's about someone you're in tune with. And then across thousands of miles, that person knows what you're thinking about and answers you. And it's all mental.
I don't know what you're talking about. I only send telegrams the normal way.
But there's a point to this joke, and this is maybe where Negri's right about bringing in Freud. I think this is a deeply psychological film.
Yeah.
I mean, the point to that joke is that Mrs. Henderson, she squelches Charlie. She says, I just send telegraphs the normal way. She doesn't even want to hear about anything having to do with the unconscious.
So many people are critical of Charlie. The librarian chastises her. The cop that you mentioned is always on her case about running through the town at night. And that's
even
part
her
of her
mother.
Her mother. That's part of the discontent is that she's always being watched and judged.
Mm-hmm. Well, I believe that her awareness of the unconscious or the surreal or the dark or the another side of life is that's the part of the world that everyone else in the town is stubbornly refusing to see. You know, they're just stubbornly innocent and naive. And if she wants to talk about that sort of thing, they have to put her down. And so she feels that Uncle Charlie also knows about that side of life, and boy, is she right.
Yeah,
but she doesn't.
And
yeah.
The contrast, he comes from a world desiccated and corrupt. You know, the opening shots of New Jersey, a landscape filled with empty lots and rundown houses and boarding rooms and
abandoned machines rusting in a vacant lot.
In itinerant people fishing off the dead looking river. That is the world that he comes from, and he's bringing it with him.
Yeah, he's going to penetrate the town. And Charlie's right in an ironic way. He is going to save them. He's going to save her in a sense, because he's bringing the shadow into Santa Rosa. And as we know, I won't give it away, but as we know at the end of the movie, no one in the town has been abused of their naive optimism.
Right.
But Charlie has matured, and she's becoming a fully developed person. He has saved her.
And so Uncle Charlie arrives in town, and he starts to ingratiate himself to the family by giving them gifts. Now, he wants to give young Charlie a ring, but at first she rejects it because she's being selfless and she thinks that just having you here is enough. I don't need a present. But Uncle Charlie forces it on her. And when she takes a closer look at it, she sees that there's an engraving on it. Now, at this point, Uncle Charlie realizes he's made a mistake because, you know, you don't hold on to souvenirs from a murder. And so he tries to get the ring back. But she likes it because it is flawed, and so she holds on to it. And then Uncle Charlie makes another mistake, and he makes a big deal about getting rid of an article in the newspaper. So now this newspaper article becomes a second object that moves the story forward as it starts to get young Charlie suspicious. And at one point, she runs off to the library. Instead of waiting for it to reopen in the morning, she runs down there to try and get in before it closes. And so we get some more tension built up as she has to get her way into the library and rap on the door and have the librarian let her in. And so finally, she gets to this article and we read it with her. And it's like a close-up of the article and the words crawl up the screen. And remember, Hitchcock started in the movies writing title cards for silent pictures. And so here we have this title card, which is the article of the newspaper that explains the murders. And here's the name of a woman who's been murdered, and the same initials are on the ring. And at this point, we have a close-up of the Charlie holding the ring on the desk with the newspaper, and then the camera pulls all the way back to the ceiling, and Charlie is there alone in this empty room, and it shows her emotional state, that she suddenly found out this truth, and she's isolated by knowing this truth. Then outside the library, Uncle Charlie waylays her. You think you know something, but you know nothing. And he takes her by the arm and pulls her aside into this bar.
Which you didn't think would exist in Santa Rosa, because it's a gin joint. She's yanked in there. She says, I've never even been in a place like this. Again, that's part of what Lisa describes her dawning appreciation of the dark side of life, the shadow in Shadow of a Doubt.
So I think that first scene where Uncle Charlie gives his niece a ring is it very important to show what you were talking about earlier. But there's two kinds of objects. Charlie treasures the relationship between them, which is not concrete. I mean, it's not something you can hold in your hand. It's that kind of object. It's a transient kind of object. It's an ephemeral kind of object. And that's all that matters to her, is that relationship. But he puts the ring on her finger as if he is putting an engagement ring on her finger. He is seducing her. And I noticed in this film that Uncle Charlie has two registers, seduction and disdain.
Right.
So he wants to turn Charlie into an object that he can manipulate. Charlie is resisting that. She wants to have a relationship. She says, we're twins. I understand you. I know what you know. He says, oh no, you don't want to know what I know. And that begins the dance. But I think, So giving her the ring is forcing her into the kind of relationship that she doesn't want. Hmm. And that continues at the Tilt Two Club. Because if you notice, when he drags her into that seedy bar and they sit down, and the ring's on the table, he cycles through these modes. He flatters her. He appeals to her sentimentality. Mm. He appeals to authority. You have to do what I say. I'm older than you. Then he scolds her. Then he threatens her. Then he tells her that she's worthless. And then finally, when they're out of the bar and they're going home and in front of their house, he appeals to her sense of family. You know, it will kill your mother.
Mm.
So he does everything he can to try to manipulate her. And at this point, we're starting to see that Charlie's becoming a woman who will not be manipulated.
Ah, yeah. You know, it's funny. One of the insights that Ms. Negra provides is that she describes Charlie's conversation with the policeman, McDonald Carey, in the town center, and we don't see the beginning of the conversation, but he obviously has revealed he's a cop, and she begins to say things. You think you can come into our family? You lied to us. You're not what you say you are. And she points out that's what she should be saying to Uncle Charlie.
Well, and also when she says that, she's detecting, and that's something I really found interesting in this film, is that it makes Charlie a detective.
Mm.
You know, she discovers that later when she's looking through at the stair with the magnifying glass, later when she sneaks into Uncle Charlie's room and finds the ring, the third time you see the ring. So she sort of turns into a detective herself.
She becomes actival.
Mm. Indeed.
So
that's a good word.
How about this script is so well constructed. And who was it that worked on the script with Hitchcock?
Thornton Wilder.
I think her name is Susan Benson, and she was, if I remember right, a playwright or a short story writer. But then, because you wanted the small town theme to be more pronounced, he hired Thornton Wilder, whose input was so important to Hitchcock that he gets his own title card in the credits. But also, there are a couple of scenes where the woman who plays the mother actually worked on. One was the dialogue in the garage between the detective and young Charlie, and the scene where the mother learns at the post-speech party that Uncle Charlie is going to leave again, and she has a breakdown.
Those lines are the most crucial lines in the film. When Emmy says, Rakes cries, and because her brother is leaving town, because her brother knows that he has to leave town or he will be found out. She says how much she's going to miss him, and she says, speaking of women in general and herself in particular, you forget that you're not you. You're just your husband's wife.
Right.
And you're talking about all these three women that were part of the dialogue, and Thornton Wilder, who is a very sympathetic to women. And of course, Hitchcock is a misogynist, and all his films are misogynistic. I mean, they're just, that's why I'm not a big Hitchcock fan like you guys, because I can't stand it. I can't stand the way he portrays women and the things he says about women. And it seems as though this movie is very different than the others. And maybe it is a result of all that collaboration. Uncle Charlie is not only a misanthrope, but he is specifically vicious about women. And he has that monologue at this dinner table. They have two dinner scenes. The second dinner table scene, where he talks about the women that deserve to die here's the thing. They're widows. Now, what is it in 1942 about a widow? A widow is free. A single woman has to kowtow to men to become married woman has to be subservient to her husband. But a widow has her own money and doesn't have to obey any man. And somehow I think this drives Uncle Charlie insane. He wants to kill them.
Yeah.
And does.
As the author of the book says, it's a measure of his nostalgia for what his childhood family was. It's probably a misplaced nostalgia, but he yearns for what the family was maybe before he got his head busted up. He resents those women for the things you just described, that they go against his conception of what a good family is all about.
Like it was in 1888,
yes.
When, of course, you know, women didn't even vote, much less, you know, like in the front. I would almost call this a feminist film. It's Charlie's movie. She's the only one in the entire town who's deep enough to have a shadow of a doubt that the way that they're living is shallow and doesn't take into consideration everything that's going on. And remember, it's 1942. So here you go. There's nothing in this film about the war at all. Maybe you see a soldier here and there, but no mention of it until, I would say, the very end. So let me get that in a second. But now Charlie, she becomes a detective. She's the only fully realized person in the town. She actually takes on alone the fight with evil, personified by Uncle Charlie. She does triumph. He falls in love with her, the other detective. She does not go to him to save her. She, in fact, does not even fall in love with him. She says she wants to be his friend, and she'll think about maybe more later. So she's being a very strong woman. She's not relying on a man to save her. And in fact, she's making the decision about whether or not she's going to accept his courtship. Then at the end, she's talking to the detective, and they're talking about Uncle Charlie, and the detective, she says, Uncle Charlie had this terrible attitude about life. He didn't trust people. He hated them. He believed that we didn't know what life was really like. And the detective says to her, it's not as bad as all that. It's just that the world needs watching, like your Uncle Charlie. And that, I think, is a direct reference to the war in Europe. I think there he's saying, look, people are people. Humanity is not completely evil, but once in a while, evil erupts, like it is in Germany, and you have to keep track of it. You cannot turn a blind eye and pretend it's not going on. And that's why people like me, this detective, needs to watch.
Well, me, that's terribly ominous.
Ooh, nice one, Doug.
It's undercutting what she just said.
That's interesting. That's interesting because I was thinking that that's where Hitchcock was opening it up, because I know then Matt told me that he goes back to England and starts making propaganda films, that he was really concerned with the war.
Yes.
And it's funny that in this film, there's just no mention of it. But I would say that the movie's about deliberately not seeing the people of Santa Rosa. They deliberately don't look. And Charlie looks.
Also, overall about this film, Shadow of a Doubt, I love how it's shot there in this town and not in the back lot of Universal or any other studio. Right. So you have actual streets and sidewalks and trees and yards and houses. I mean, that church, I could probably find five churches like that in Southeast Portland. It has a real verisimilitude of being set in America at that time, in a time before television, before all the social media. At one point, Charlie says, you know, all we do, we go to, we have dinner, we wash the dishes, and then we go to bed. And that was that was life back then. Well, this is Shadow of a Doubt from 1942, a movie with more in it every time you see
it. That's right. That's right.
And Hitchcock himself even said it was his favorite movie. I think everything's so perfectly put together. He got a very solid script. He was able to work with at least the one woman and to get the dialogue right. He uses a lot of camera techniques, some of which I think he's using for the first time. There's nice tracking shots after cuts throughout this whole movie, the overhead shots. I think it's like the first movie where everything kind of comes together. Right after this, he did Lifeboat, which was just sort of a challenge thing that he would do. It's all in a lifeboat. Then he goes to England to do some movies. Then he comes back and he does Spellbound and Notorious. I think this is sort of a prelude to this period when Hitchcock just did hit after hit for over a 10-year period.
Right.
I think starting with like Spellbound and ending with Psycho or The Birds, whatever you want to do. Then he went into a sort of a slump. But I think it's a great movie.
Part of the slump.
Pardon me?
I think The Birds is definitely part
of the slump. I think you're right. You know, I do like Marnie. There's some interesting things, but it's like a failed masterpiece at that point. So Vertigo and Psycho are kind of his last great movies.
Can somewhere. I ask you guys one thing about the film technique that I found really interesting was all the parallelism, all the match editing. So you have this scene where Uncle Charlie is following Charlie out of the living room, and then there's a cut and he's following her down the street. Mm. And that happens over and over again, that you have these parallels. This happens at this point. And not only is it the same action with the same, but it's the same composition.
Yeah.
The same graphic in the scene. Did you notice that?
He's fascinated by dualities, if that's not too pretentious a word. This comes up again a few years later in Strangers on a Train, where two similar or matched people are constantly interlocked, or you know, it opens up with parallel tracks of a train and culminates in them, two men trading murders to solve problems in their lives. But again, that parallelism is something that it really appealed to him. And she points out in the book how almost everything in the movie comes in twos.
Yeah, she does. Yeah. I mean, starting with, of course, the Charlies, but it's very subtle everywhere. Two right. dinner scenes, two just amazing.
I think this is Alma Ravel, his wife's influence. And she had been an established film editor and writer when Hitchcock started back in the 20s in the British film industry. And she worked on all of his films. This is one of them that she gets an official credit.
Yeah, for editing, creating this visual backbone that links scenes within the scene and then scenes with each other scenes, like with the rule of three of the objects. It's connective tissue between certain elements of the film so that the viewer has a through line to hold on to.
Now, the disc that is available is really nice. There's lots of nice extras on it and interviews with even Teresa Wright was still alive at the time of the disc was made. So this is really a great film to catch, even if you're not a Hitchcock fan. Would you agree, Lisa?
It's true. And I like his movies in spite of myself because they're so well done. But in this movie, you don't have to hate yourself for enjoying it.
There's a lot of controversy about Alfred Hitchcock's treatment of his leading ladies, and there are two books that are the primary sources. For the prosecution is Donald Spotto's Spellbound by Beauty, Alfred Hitchcock and His Leading Ladies, published by Hutchinson in London, and the other is Alfred Hitchcock, A Life in Darkness and Light by Patrick McGilligan, for the defense, published by HarperCollins. Whichever side you fall on, each side of the case is treated with a lot of detail, and that we'll just leave, which will leave it up to the reader to make up their mind.
The book we're looking at today is a monograph on Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt by Diane Negra,
with Matthew of KBOO's Gremlin Time and Professor Lisa Neville of Cortland University in New York State. And we will be back next week with another Film at 11.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Could I get two of those zucchini, please?
Sure. Anything else for you today?
What is that over in the basket?
Oh, honey, that is the organic, homegrown More Talk Radio with Cecile Prescott and Celeste Carey.
Wow, I'll take one.
It is so great. Every Monday at 8 in the morning.
How do I get more?
Well, you can support programs like this with donations by going to kboo.fm/give or texting KBOO to 44321. It is the Fresh Off the Vine Fall Fun Drive, so it's a great time to give.
More Talk Radio sounds new.